Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
Live from the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. On June 16, 2015, Donald Trump rode down his escalator and announced he was running for president. Few people at that time took it seriously. One reason was because he said this: when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're sending people who have a lot of problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. It sounded like Trump was attacking Latino voters, who at the time were considered to be the future of American politics. But now, not so much. There is no singular figure in America that we can point to as the leader of the Latino voter bloc. And we've seen that the Latino vote is shifting to the right, sometimes to the far right. Zapata County on the border, not far south of Bexar County, is 94% Hispanic, and in 2020, Trump won Zapata County by 5 percentage points. That was a shocker. Other border counties in South Texas also saw a red shift, a GOP gaining ground there, right where the wall is being built. And some might say that sounds contradictory. Well, not so much if you actually know the lay of the land. Journalist Paula Ramos investigates in her new book, Defector, the rise of the Latino far right and what it means for America. And Paula, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I really appreciate it.
So let's talk about the title of the book, Defector. It does sound judgy, as if people are breaking against some sort of loyalty. What's behind the title?
No, I think it's the idea is to challenge what we assume is supposed to be this idea of who Latinos are supposed to be loyal to. No, so of course, to defect means to sort of abandon a presumed loyalty. And I think to your point, David, for many years, the assumption has been that Latinos are these sort of natural, Democratic and progressive voters. And that has also been sort of the theory of change for the Democratic Party. You know, this idea that as Latinos would grow in this country and the numbers would increase, the story went that the Democratic Party would sort of use that as a winning formula. And so the idea of calling the book Defectors is to challenge that assumption, you know, to really get us to think of this idea. But truly, if we really put politics aside, no, if we really put our biases and stereotypes aside, who are Latinos supposed to be loyal to? And the answer is not black and white. No, and I think we're at a point in American politics where Latinos are showing that they are not necessarily loyal to the Democratic Party. And in fact, that there are these tendencies that perhaps make a growing but small group of Latinos more loyal, not just to Republicans, but to the even movement of Trumpism.
Our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. If you want to call in, talk about the insights into why you think more Latinos are voting for Republicans, what's behind all that. And so I just think, Paula, that it's probably a good thing that people will be making decisions about how they vote, not based solely on their last name or their racial identity.
Oh, of course. Absolutely. I mean, look, I think everyone has the freedom to vote for whomever they want to. And to be clear, when we say that Latinos are not a monolith, that's part of the discussion. No, we always talk about sort of our diversity, but within that picture of what it means to not be a monolith is the idea that, yes, the majority of Latinos are still Democratic voters, but historically, Republicans have typically gained at least like 30% of the Latino vote. But what I do think is somewhat alarming, or at least I do think that it merits a conversation, is the idea that we're not even talking about Republicans and Democrats, but I think the idea of someone like Donald Trump that in this moment is promising mass deportations, someone that sort of flirts with the idea of, you know, January 6th and sort of, you know, these not really respecting the rule of law, that someone like him, that to your point, started his 2016 campaign sort of criminalizing Mexican immigrants, that he is polling anywhere between 35% to 40% with this Latino voting bloc. And so that, I think, is worth discussing, you know, because that to me is very different from a Latino voting bloc that is Republican or Democrat. That to me says something else.
Right. It's a head scratcher. We were like, well, if he is attacking, well, people are saying he's attacking immigrants. He's not attacking me. I'm not an immigrant. I grew up here. So, you know, I don't care what he said about people from Mexico. Matter of fact, I've seen people from Mexico coming up here, and I'm not so sure about them myself. So maybe he's talking directly to me. I mean, is that what some people are thinking?
I think you're right, David. I mean, I think that's kind of the psychology that's happening. You know, I think when we hear things like, oh, you know, there's a block of Latinos, and I want to be very clear, you know, we're still talking about a minority, but a growing minority. But when you hear this idea that there is a small but growing group of Latinos that are warming up to the idea of mass deportations and are warming up to the idea of building the wall, and you see them among Donald Trump's crowds saying things like deport them back, send them back, build the wall, you're right. People can't make sense of it. But I think Trumpism right now is really betting on this idea that there is a segment of Latino voters in this country that have become so Americanized, you know, and so assimilated that they too can sort of tap into the nativism and the xenophobia and the anti-immigrant sentiment. And they could do it with ease, you know, because I think overshadowing all of it, you know, we can get into the history and sort of the nuances of it all, but I think overshadowing all of it, I think there's a fear, David, among some Latinos, that they don't want to be sort of lumped with immigrants, no? They don't want mainstream America to see them, you know, as these sort of like immigrants and these sort of perpetual foreigners. And there is reason to understand where that fear comes from. You know, even if you look at studies, even if you look at something like the anti-Latino hate crimes in this country, they specifically spike when mainstream media extensively covers the border and extensively covers things like there's a caravan, or there's an invasion, or immigrants are criminals. That's when that sort of anti-Latino sentiment spikes towards Latinos that are a U.S. citizen that, to your point, may identify more with being an American than being an immigrant.
And so to become even more American, they say, I'm going to embrace the right. I'm going
to put
the Trump flag on my pickup truck and just be a total MAGA guy.
Well, I think, you know, I think, first of all, I do believe that being a Latino or being an immigrant does not make you immune to xenophobia, right? Like the anti-immigrant rhetoric and the anti-immigrant history in this country is very deep and it's very visceral and it's contagious. No, if you hear every single day, like you do from huge megaphones, that there's an invasion, no, that immigrants are dangerous to this country. If you hear every day that, you know, there's this existential threat to your being, that I can understand, right, how a lot of people can feel fear. I'm talking to you from New York City. We're miles away from the southern border. And I can't tell you how many people, even being miles away from the southern border, because of the rhetoric that you hear on TV and from someone like Donald Trump, literally believe, know that their life is at risk because of migrants. And so I understand where that fear comes from. Because I think on top of that, there is a group of Latinos that don't just feel that fear in a very real way, but to your point, also have to prove a sense of belonging in their own country. You know, have to sort of prove to sort of this, you know, mainstream white America that, look, I am part of you. You know, and so the sort of game of otherizing, you know, we can also buy into that.
Okay, so we got to take a break here. We'll continue our conversation. Bonnie, I see you on the board. I'm going to get you on the air. When we come back from this break, the number is 833-877-8255. If you want to jump in here, we're talking about the book Defectors, the Rise of the Latino Far Right and What It Means for America with Paula Ramos. The Source continues after a one-minute break.
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. Paula Ramos is with us. Her new book is Defectors, The Rise of the Latino Far Right and What It Means for America. You can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Let's go to Bonnie. Bonnie, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Thank you. around 2017, right after the Orange 45 got in office, there was all of that hate toward the Arab community. And I'm a Democrat, so I just consider Donald Trump to me as just the most massive liar. And it would be nice if people could just understand, you know, we in our real lives, we recognize liars, and we in our workplace, in our communities, we recognize people who are liars, and we say, oh, okay, that's a liar. I don't have to take that person so seriously. But during that 2017 time, all the hate speech from Trump about Arab community, and, you know, I was at the grocery store, and I don't know, I was struggling with my cart or something, and there was this, a very kind Arab family that with babies in the stroller, and they, you know, the husband came and helped me with my cart, and they were so sweet and so kind.
So Bonnie, tell me again, try and get right to the point. What are you trying to tell us?
We're human beings, and we have to trust who okay. our own observations. Human beings are all unique.
All right. Bonnie, so thank you so much for the call. So I'm going to go from that call, and I'm going to play a sound clip. And this is from the DPS director, McCraw, which he gave recently, where he compares migrants to cockroaches. Let's give a listen.
I mean, somebody would find it harsh using the term, you know, infestation and cockroaches and things like that. All you have to do is interview or spend some time with some victims, some migrant victims that are here in this country. You'll understand that the governor has not overstated the issue. In fact, he's well stated the issue. And Texas is not going to allow any part of this state to be infested with that type of disease.
Paulo Ramos, so the head of the DPS, the head guy running Operation Lone Star, calling migrants cockroaches and saying we have an infestation. What about that language?
Well, I think to tie it to what Bonnie is saying, right, I think part of what Bonnie is trying to say is that how can you ground people in facts, right, in the midst of all the hate, no? And when you have someone like him, no, saying things like we're being infested, no, and comparing sort of migrants and asylum seekers to cockroaches, then again, how can you ground people in the very same facts that the DPS shows themselves, no? According to the Texas Department of Public Safety's own records, it is the case that U.S.-born natives are more likely to commit crimes than undocumented immigrants and immigrants, right? We just have to look at the numbers. And so we're at a time, David, where you know, the sort of hatred and the rhetoric and the fear-mongering, to Bonnie's point, is distorting reality, you know, and it's creating the sort of dystopian fear for a lot of people. And so our job is to hear what this DPS director just said, and tell people the facts. No, there's no evidence, there's no statistical evidence to confirm that there is, in fact, a migrant crime wave in this country. The FBI's own number shows that violent crimes are down. Every single survey, including from Stanford at a national level, even at Texas, will show you that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes, if we're going to go there, than U.S.-born citizens. And so, again, no, let's ground us in the real threats that we're facing. No, it is not migrants.
Yeah. So what about him using, he's playing the disgust card.
Oh, yeah.
And why that's important in driving some Latinos into the right. But I mean, the importance of disgust. Disgust is the easiest emotion to read on someone else's face.
Right.
And it totally, when you employ it in politics, it's you know, very effective.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I talk about disgust, you know, because there's a science behind it. Disgust, more so than anger, more so than fear, is the driving force behind dehumanizing someone, you know? And so if you're able to elicit and evoke disgust in someone, that is the best tactic to ensure that someone has the ability to dehumanize another being. And so what he just said is something that Donald Trump does constantly, right? Which is get people, train them, teach them to feel disgust in the face of other people, you know? Whether it's Haitian migrants or whether it's asylum seekers that are Mexican. And so you're right, it's all based on disgust. But that's just not something that we see in the realm of immigration.
Right.
That essence of disgust. Yeah, that also happens with like the LGBTQ community, you know, the trans community. It's the same sort of theory.
Let's go to the caller, Michael. And Michael, you're on the air.
Hello. There's a concept called implicit bias, which says people have biases, which people might call racism, but I'm just going to call biases, that they just cannot see as biases. I think anybody who thinks it is strange for a Spanish surname person to be a Republican or a Trump supporter has those implicit biases, which somebody might call racist. I'm not going to call it racism. I'm going to call it biases. And they're just showing those implicit biases that they cannot see. Thank you.
All right, Michael, thank you for the call and your reaction, Paulo Ramos.
No, I think Michael's completely right. No, I think so many of us, whether we're white, brown, black, like everyone carries these implicit biases. And one of the things that I talk about the book is that even as Latinos, no, even as Hispanics, we too carry not only implicit biases, but even our own internalized racism. No, and that's why I keep saying this idea that we're not sort of immune to Donald Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric or sort of when he uses this divisive racial anti-black rhetoric. Like, we're not immune to that. And I think because he's able to tap into a sort of racial and ethnic grievance, he taps into these biases that are familiar to us as Latinos because of our history with colonialism, you know, because of sort of the legacy of a colonialism that did in fact enact a caste system. And that also makes things like talking about race very complicated for many of us. So I couldn't agree more with Michael.
So I'm going to play a sound cut. And this is from the former head of the Proud Boys, Enrico Taddeo. And you feature him quite a bit in your book. How do you identify Enrique Taddeo? Beyond his name, the name obviously tells us something, but what do we need to know?
Yeah, look, Enrique Taddeo is best known for being the former chairman of the Proud Boys. No, he's someone that really rises to power after the 2016 election. He then becomes sort of the mastermind behind the January 6th insurrection. And so now he's serving his time.
20 years.
Sentenced. 20 years, exactly. So he's serving the law, I believe, still to this day, no, the longest sentence for anyone that sort of was involved in the January 6th insurrection. Now, what's interesting about someone like Enrique Taddeo, no, just beyond his name, that sort of may allude to the fact that he is Hispanic, he is Latino. Enrique Taddeo is also a Black Latino. No? He's an Afro-Cuban. He's someone that is from Miami. And I got to meet him in 2018. So sort of before he really becomes radicalized by the sense of power that he finds in the Proud Boys. And it was super interesting, David, no, to see sort of the evolution of this man, no, that goes from being this like ordinary Cuban man and
given all this power and attention responding to the toxic masculinity of the Proud Boys. And so I just want to say the reason why he got so much time, of course, he was an organizer of the Proud Boys on January 6th, but also he was a repeat offender. He had been convicted of burning a Black Lives Matter banner that belonged to a church, and also he had an illegal gun clip. And let's play. This is Enrique talking about himself.
It's conservatives with an attitude now, conservatives that believe in more freedoms, believe in more liberty, but also believe in more law and order when it comes to certain aspects of things like immigration, these riots, you know. And I think we've changed. And when I say we, I mean, I don't mean like us, the Proud Boys. I mean, we as a conservative movement as a whole have changed the Republican Party for good.
So the Proud Boys have distanced themselves from him, not because of his conviction, not because of anything he's done, but because of his DNA.
Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things about Enrique, you just said it, is like after he sort of rises to power with the Proud Boys and he really becomes the leader of the Latino Trump sort of movement that happens during 2016 and then during 2020, like after he does all of that, come November 2020, here comes the election. Of course, Donald Trump loses. And one of the first things that happens is that the Proud Boys, specifically one of the leaders called Kyle Chapman, one of the first things he does is he says, you know what, we have to sort of reaffirm who we are. And the Proud Boys is a group that is always sort of devoted to white race. And he says, in white race alone, and no other race. And he says that, and no other race. And so in that statement, he really tries to distance the Proud Boys from someone like Enrique Tarrio, from this Black Cuban man who really helped the Proud Boys for a little bit, because it shielded them from being criticized as, this racist group, this white supremacist group. And that's something that they would say all the time. Well, how can we be white supremacists when we have Enrique Tarrio, a Black Latino man at the head of us? How can we be white supremacists? And so he just became a shield. And within a matter of months and seconds, he being Enrique Tarrio, understood just how tenuous that white power actually was.
Right. So it makes the point about the transactional and conditional nature of whiteness. Mm-hmm. So a person who may think they're white today may not be able to claim whiteness later. That can be taken away from you. And that's what we saw here. And I'm wondering about, on a broader scale, with the rise of the Latino far right, and they say, okay, I am part of the white movement, or even white nationalism. How far will that take you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll even say that Enrique Tarrio is an extreme example of that. No, but I think what I really want to ground us in is that, of course, when we think of the far right and Trumpism, we're thinking about people like Enrique Tarrio and the Proud Boys and other sort of groups.
What about Nick Fuentes?
Nick Fuentes, exactly. But I will say that what is also happening is just that, even former Democrats I've spoken to, or some even independents, like the pathway towards Trumpism is a lot more seamless than we think, for many, many different reasons and many different elements. But just take race, for example. Even I'm talking to you from New York City. At the Bronx, I've had some interesting conversations with other Black Latinos, like Enrique Tarrio, in this case, more Dominicans and Puerto Ricans. And so part of the conversations that I had with them, and many of these folks are Trump supporters, and the reason why they really, really like Donald Trump now, just like they did in 2020, was precisely because of the way that Donald Trump was talking about Black Lives Matter and really criminalizing Black Lives Matter and really reinforcing in people's minds that Black Lives Matter and the movement that sort of saw a lot of momentum during George Floyd, that had to be crushed. And that resonated with some of the Afro-Latinos that I talked to in the Bronx. And to your point, David, how do you make sense of that? Well, again, it goes back to the history. One of the things that the Spanish colonizers did, and I'm sorry for taking us in this long history lesson, but I think it's important. One of the things that, as I said, the Spanish colonizers did is, of course, they created a caste system where, of course, enslaved people were all the way at the bottom, followed by indigenous people, and then followed by white folks, the white colonizers. But within that caste system, that also gave place to racial mixing, to mestizaje. And that in and of itself created this illusion, this false illusion of a raceless Latin America and this raceless Latin American societies. And more than anything, it gave all of us, whether you're Black Latino, Indigenous Latino, sort of white Latino, it gave all of us the ability to always claim a direct line to whiteness, and always claim a direct line to the Spanish colonizers. And so in the United States, when we understand sort of the complicated racial history that we carry through colonialism until now, how does all of that manifest in U.S. politics? Well, it leads some people, when they have to face an America that tells you you're either Black or you're white, it leads a lot of Latinos, including Afro-Latinos, to choose whiteness, to choose to be part of whiteness, even though they are racially Black in the United States. But it goes back to sort of our idea and our foundation of colorism and of race in Latin America.
They are a class apart. Let's go. So Paula Ramos is going to be in San Antonio on October 7th, on Monday, October 7th. She's going to be here at the TPR headquarters. She's going to be having a conversation and a book signing, and we're going to be looking forward to having her then. So that's part of the San Antonio Book Festival. And we're going to continue our conversation. I got a bunch of callers I need to get on the air. Claiborne, hang on, and others. I'll get you on the air as well. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. The Source continues after this break. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. With me on the line, Paola Ramos. Her new book is Defectors, The Rise of the Latino Far Right and What It Means for America. You can call in at 833-877-8255. Let's go to Claiborne. Sorry I had you on hold so long, Claiborne, but you're on the air.
Not a problem. I was just calling about the myth of the monolith, i.e. Latinos, African Americans. The local station, NPR station at home back in the late 90s, people were going after, quote, the Latino vote. And it was pointed out, I think at the time, 70% of Latinos are Mexican American or Mexican origin. But at home in D.C., Virginia, Maryland, 70% Guatemalan, El Salvadoran, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they didn't like each other. And then there are the people who are amused with the telenovelas starring blonde Castilian types, which ignores mestizo, indigenous, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And as she said, there are also people, it's like, oh, as white, and close the door behind them.
All right, Claiborne, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Paola Ramos, not a monolith, not ethnically or, national origin or political opinions.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when we, like we said before, not to not be a monolith means understanding that many Latinos obviously look like me, light-skinned Latinos with immense privilege. And there's so many, over 4 million Afro-Latinos, there's hundreds and thousands of indigenous Latinos. We're a group where Latinos are the fastest growing group of evangelicals. But then you zoom in and you also see that Latinos are the fastest growing group within Muslims. You see a group that even among the millennial generation identifies as queer in higher rates than any other demographic. And so, yes, and also to David's point, we come from many countries, of course, not just Mexico, but Guatemala and El Salvador and Venezuela and Cuba. And so that makes us both a very complicated, but also a very beautiful community. And I do have to say, I think the reality has been that Latinos have had a somewhat unified voice over the last 40 decades, no, particularly at a time when Latinos were sort of, booming and blossoming and really finding their way in this country. And for over, 40, 30 years, they did vote in a cohesive way, no, and they did overwhelmingly vote for Democrats, and they were overwhelmingly preoccupied with things like immigration, no, and honestly, with the same issues that any other Americans care about. We care about the economy, we care about housing, we care about healthcare, and also immigration. I think what we're seeing now is just a community that is vastly different from what we were 20, 30 years ago during my parents' generation. No, we are younger. We are third generation Latinos, is the fastest growing group. We overwhelmingly speak English, we're US born. So I think the complexity is like we are finding our voice, no? We're challenging parties in a different way. And we're finding different identities in a different way. And so I think that's kind of what's happening.
Well, right now in America, we really don't have a leader who could be like, this is the leader of the Latino vote or even the Mexican-American vote nationally. Actually, the leader, the most prominent Latino politicians are Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz. And you can say, well, Ted Cruz, people say Ted Cruz is as Mexican as Tom Cruise, which of course, I know that not to be true because I know Ted Cruz goes to Mexico quite frequently. He goes to Cancun, but where is a prominent progressive, Democrat that leads the Latino vote? And why wasn't there something in the Harris campaign that part of this as well?
Well, actually, the Harris campaign is led by a Latina, no? Julie Chavez, her campaign manager, is a Latina, no? She is she comes from a Mexican family. She comes from an immigrant family. So the Harris campaign is actually being led by a Latina who has held many important and prominent roles in Democratic politics. I think what is happening now, and it's a good thing, is that there's not just one sort of Dolores Huerta or one sort of Ted Cruz, but you're seeing the rise of a lot more Latinos that are in Congress, no? Beyond Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, I mean, there's AOC, whether people love her or not, but she has a huge following, you know, and she's made a big mark. There's obviously Nidia Velázquez in New York. I mean, these are just folks that are in my state.
They don't really resonate with South Texas. And, you know, even Ruben Gallego, who is in Arizona running for Senate, you know, it doesn't really feel like somebody who represents, you know, the Latino vote, the voice in South Texas.
No. I mean, look, and of course, I think regionally, people will be looking at different things and different aspects from different leaders. But even a place like South Texas is so interesting, right? You have a place like the 15th Congressional District that, of course, voted for someone like Mónica de la Cruz. And then you have someone like Mayra Flores, not too far away from Mónica de la Cruz's in district, who tried to make the case, no, that she also could sort of be the new Latina conservative in that district. And her message at the end didn't resonate. No, it ended up still being a Democrat that won that district. And so I think some of the values and the stories that resonate with South Texas obviously resonate differently with some Puerto Ricans in Pennsylvania, and they do with some Mexican Americans in the border. And that's okay. No.
They ask the question, why are these people in South Texas? And this is where we're really seeing it. You know, we see the red shift. And they're acting like you're defectors. And says, no, we are, you know, I work for the oil company and we do drilling and I'm worried about the Green New Deal. I don't like that. I'm going to vote Republican.
Well, again, in South Texas, they have historically voted for Democrats. No, that's a fact. That's why Mónica de la Cruz's victory was so historic, no, because she was able to flip this historically blue district. And so it is a fact. And so I think the idea that now we're seeing an evolution, that is an evolution. That is a difference. I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm no one to judge, but it is a difference. And so I think that two stories can be true at the same time. No, there is a group of people that are no longer sort of feeling at home with the Democratic Party and that are finding something in the Republican Party. But that doesn't take away from the fact that historically, Democrats have been the sort of home for a majority of Latino voters. That has been the case. And that is why these names like Mayra Flores, Mónica de la Cruz are so prominent right now, because they're changing that narrative.
Let's go to another caller. Leo, you're on the air, Leo. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for having this topic on air. I'm going to edit my comments a little bit from where I originally called, because y'all have covered a lot of ground since I called. But first, I want to say to the topic you're talking about, like, why isn't there a more prominent Latino leading the Latino vote? Man, I'm going to tell you straight up, this country is not ready for a hardcore Latino to be in a position of power. Like, Chicanos alike, you know, they're not ready to have that kind of radical view in a position of power. And we're hearing it a lot from the campaign's rhetoric right now, because they're already talking about how much of a leftist she is, because she was raised by a Marxist and all that stuff that we're hearing, right? But the original purpose that I called was because what I'm seeing a lot of is that the type of book, and in my case, the type of Mexican support that we're seeing for Donald Trump is rooted in a lot of what is being discussed. But I think that historical patriarchy and deep-rooted misogyny and the Latino culture also has a huge proponent to play in what we're seeing, because there is a lot. So, like, Donald Trump's language, his actions have validated a lot of the racism and misogyny that we're seeing now, right?
Right.
Through that lens.
All right, Leo, I'm going to get an answer here from Paola. So can you talk about that?
No, Leo, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's many different factors that are playing out in the same time. And I think there is something very scary for a segment of Latino men, you know, when they're saying, when they're seeing an American society that is changing, where women and women of color have prominent roles, you know, where it's these sort of like gender dynamics are changing, when gender norms are changing, when we're normalizing things like being queer and gay and trans, you know? I think that makes certain men, you know, and I've sort of witnessed that in my own life, in my own reporting and around me. I think it makes certain people feel uncomfortable, you know, at this idea that these systems and these norms and these like power dynamics are changing. And I think that is, to your point, that absolutely is one of the reasons why some men find Donald Trump's narrative appealing, because it takes them back to a place that they resonate with. No, that's kind of what Enrique Darrio's conversation with me was all about. No, ensuring that sort of women understood their role and men understood their role. No, ensuring that marriage looked a certain way between a man and a woman. And so I couldn't agree more. And that also helps explain some of the gender gaps that you see among some Latino men and Latina women. You saw that in Nevada. You saw that in North Carolina. And so, I absolutely believe that that is also one of the main drivers.
You look at graduation rates for Latinas from universities outpacing Latinos. There are more women from, you know, in this community graduating and doing well. And that's also a source of conflict in the community. Let's take another break. We'll get some more callers on the air. Lauren, you'll be next. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio, having a conversation with Paula Ramos. Her book is Defectors, The Rise of the Latino Far Right and What It Means for America. Stay with us. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Paula Ramos is with us, journalist and the author of Defectors, The Rise of the Latino Far Right and What It Means for America. And let's go to Lauren. And Lauren, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I keep hearing that the economy and immigration are two of the top issues in this election. So I'd like to hear more about the kind of impact that is expected from Trump's planned mass roundup and deportation of undocumented immigrants, how that would impact our grocery bills, the housing market, and our economy in general.
All right, Lauren, thank you so much for that call. Paula Ramos, it seems like trying to do a mass roundup would not be good for the economy.
No, it wouldn't be good. And I think let's remember, like, undocumented immigrants pay taxes. No, they pay federal taxes. Undocumented immigrants are at the heart of how we feed ourselves every day. Dreamers, our teachers, their nurses.
They pay so many taxes,
David. But I think the interesting thing is to frame this conversation now not just about a sort of Latino or immigrant issue. It's impacting all Americans. No, there's over 22 million people that are living in mixed status families, and that means where they're a combination of U.S. citizens and, of course, undocumented immigrants. There's over 10 million U.S. citizens that are also living within those sort of mixed status families. And so when we talk about mass deportations, we're not just talking about this huge, huge financial blowout that will happen to this country if it happens, but also just think about logistically, you know, the amount of money and resources that it would take for local policemen, you know, to not just do their job, but then suddenly to be deputized, you know, to become these de facto border patrol agents, which is essentially what Donald Trump has said repeatedly, you know, that he would deputize local law enforcement to carry out and help him carry out those plans. So logistically, the amount of money and resource that even something like that would entail is huge, no? Beyond just the sort of economic impact that it would have. And so what's interesting, David, and we're seeing, yes, the economy is the number one issue, as it always has been, But I think this election will come down to one of the two most controversial issues, no? Which is immigration and the issue of abortion. Immigration, of course, has been a mobilizing issue for Trump and for Republicans. And abortion seems to be a very mobilizing issue for the Democratic Party and for the vice president. So that will be interesting for me to watch which one of those two issues will outweigh the other.
I'm going to play a clip. This is Senator and Vice President candidate for the Republican Party, J.D. Vance, answering a question about Springfield, Ohio, about dogs and cats being eaten and whether or not the Haitians should be deported.
So I know you've talked a lot about how we need to deport illegal aliens, but I wanted to ask you, the majority of the Haitians in Springfield came under TPS, so they are here legally. And I know you've expressed a lot of your issues with the TPS program and wanting to change that under a Trump-Vance administration. But I guess my question for you is, if you become the vice president under a Trump administration, what will you guys do about the migrants that are already there, since they did arrive legally? And a follow-up to that, if you plan to deport them, how would you do that legally?
Well, look, this is a media and Kamala Harris fact check that I want to clarify and clear up right now. And now the media loves to say that the Haitian migrants, hundreds of thousands of them, by the way, 20,000 in Springfield, but hundreds of thousands of them all across our country, they are here legally. And what they mean is that Kamala Harris used two separate programs, mass parole and temporary protective status. She used two programs to wave a wand and to say, we're not going to deport those people here. Well, if Kamala Harris waves the wand illegally and says these people are now here legally, I'm still going to call them an illegal alien. An illegal action from Kamala Harris does not make an alien legal. That is not how this works.
So Paulo Ramos, we're hearing there from J.D. Vance, is that even when you're legal, you're illegal?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the scary or frightening or alarming moment that we're in right now, David, is that when we think about Donald Trump's mass deportation plans, it used to be that he was just talking about undocumented immigrants. And it was undocumented immigrants who had a target in their back. And now we know that he himself doesn't even know where to draw the line. No, now suddenly being a legal immigrant, like many of the Haitian migrants that he's talking about, also puts you at risk. And so where does
that stop? They suddenly decide, hey, Paula, I don't like the way you look. I don't like the way you talk. I don't like what you say. You're now illegal, even if you are a natural born citizen.
David, and that's the question. Where does that stop? No, let's remember during the days of Sheriff Gerard Pio in Arizona, during the era of SB 1070, one of the consequences of that is that, of course, it led to racial profiling. No, and so Latinos, just because of the color of your skin, you could be driving and you would be stopped by local policemen and local sheriffs because of the color of your skin. No, in traffic light stops. And so we could go back to that era. But again, who gets to decide? No, is it because they're Black immigrants that he's now suddenly deciding that makes them illegal? Because let's remember that one of the last things that Donald Trump did in 2020 before he stepped out of the White House, one of the last things he did is that he granted temporary protected status to Venezuelan immigrants. No? And so again, who decides who's legal and who is not? And when they say that they believe in the rule of law, do they really? No? Because it seems like they nod or only when it sort of justifies their own theories of who gets to belong in this country and not.
We got an email from a listener. He's saying that the McCraw clip that we played earlier was being taken out of context and that McCraw was specifically referring to the Tren de Aguan gang members. I'm saying that name
Venezuelan
wrong.
Gang members.
The Venezuelan. And as if that was something that would justify the dehumanization of individuals. And this whole Venezuelan gang thing is now being blown out of proportion as we're seeing as more investigation is going on. There are Venezuelan gangs, but now it's become the whipping boy of the latest news cycle. So anyway, I put that out there. Some say that clip is out of context. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Randall.
Okay. You had a caller a couple of calls back talking about Latino culture, machismo, and all that. This is going to piggyback on that. a couple of weeks ago, NPR addressed this on All Things Considered, this shift from the Latino vote to the right. They asked one Latino gentleman who he was going to vote for. He said he was voting for Trump because Trump is rich and he knows a lot about economics. Now, a lot of our recent immigrants have come to America from Venezuela and a lot of other despotic societies, societies where you don't ask about a candidate's economic policies or education or social issues. No, you back the guy with the biggest, tallest herd of awe-inspiring banners marching down the street. Because from the day you were born, through no fault of your own, that's what you've been conditioned to do. Think about Stalin, Mussolini, Gaddafi, Kim Jong-un, Maduro. Big banners with heroic, godlike images. Now, David, you talked earlier about a Trump flag on a pickup. Look at all the Trump images. Trump as a superhero, Trump walking with lions, and, of course, Trump as a god, if not the god. When you're coming from Venezuela or Colombia or Nicaragua, I mean, sorry, but this is what you've been trained to do.
All right. Thank you so much, Randall, for that call. So the thing about him, I've heard it said that he has a toxic masculinity appeal. There are questions being raised whether when Trump finally leaves politics, whether or not he will still see this red shift following the Republicans. But what do you make of that, Paula?
No, I think he makes such an interesting point. I think there's sort of two versions to understand that appeal. No? One is the sort of the toxic masculinity that we talked about, which to me is more about sort of, you know, this discomfort around certain, you know, gender norms and the way the country's shifting. But I think what Randall's really talking about is fascinating, right? Because it's this idea of the strong man rule appeal that he actually does have.
The authoritarian.
Yeah. And, you know, that's so interesting because, you know, Democrats have been convinced and they do this playbook, which is that if you cast Donald Trump, you know, as a dictator, as un caudillo, which is a word that they use many times, you know, a strongman ruler in Latin America, if you cast him as such, they are convinced, and the strategy has gone, that, you know, there's a group of Latinos that would really be very scared of that image, and that it would make them vote for the Democratic Party. And to his point, like, Latinos have a very complicated history with strongman rule, you know, in many ways, as he said, like, we have been conditioned to believe that when democracy feels kind of messy around us, you know, and chaotic and unstable, that at times it's strongman rule what we need.
Yeah, we had Patron democracy in South Texas.
Exactly. But again, to take us back to history very quickly, like even the liberator of Latin America, you know, someone like Simon Bolivar in 1815 in the 19th century, he was actually already calling this out. You know, he himself said back then, he was like, look, the American states will actually need paternalistic governments. You know, they will need these like charismatic strongman rulers to cure the Latin American states from their wounds and their ulcers, you know, to cure them from the despotism and the war. And so you see throughout history in Latin America that, yes, then that gave sort of the rise to the 19th century caudillos throughout the continent. But then on top of that, David, you see a United States that during the 20th century, you know, during the Cold War, they sort of tried to install some strongmen rulers, and they supported and backed some military juntas, all in the name of ridding the West and Latin America from communism. And there you see that in Chile.
And they wave that flag all the time.
They wave that flag. And so yes, I think there's some truth to what he's saying. No, we have been conditioned to see strongmen rulers through different eyes.
Paulo Ramos is the author of the book Defectors, The Rise of the Latino Far Right, What It Means for America. She's going to be here at the Texas Public Radio headquarters on Monday, October 7th with the Get Lit event with the San Antonio Book Festival. You can come and meet her, get a book sign, and hear her in conversation. Paulo, so good to talk to you again. Thank you.
David, really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.